Hello, it's Debbie back again, reading from the e-edition of the Decatur Herald and Review on Wednesday, January 11th, 2017. Starting with the first page, there's four articles here, and the first one is a national, Obama says goodbye with a plea for democracy. This is by Christy Parsons and Michael A. Mamoli, Tribune News Service writers. Chicago. President Barack Obama marked the end of his presidency with the same message of hope that launched him into the White House, challenging Americans during primetime farewell address to renew their commitment to democratic values and persist in their optimism for change. From his hometown of Chicago, the city where he said he found purpose in public life, Obama reflected on his transition from the nation's most powerful office to one he has said is just as vital, citizen. Though Americans have largely grown more cynical about politics during his time in office, Obama said he nonetheless continued to insist that change results when, quote, ordinary people get involved, get engaged, and come together to demand it. After 8 years as president, I still believe that, he said, and it's not just my belief, it's the beating heart of our American ideal, our bold experiment in self-government, unquote. Obama's decision to deliver his final major national address from adopted hometown instead of the White House was one of the several flourishes on a tradition of goodbyes that had produced some of the most memorable speeches in presidential history, including Washington's farewell address and Eisenhower's dark warning of the military-industrial complex. Tuesday's address was orchestrated as a celebration. Obama spoke in a large convention hall a few blocks from Grant Park, where he spoke to supporters on the night of his historic election in 2008. Chicago area native Eddie Vedder warmed up the crowd by leading the Chicago Children's Choir in People Have the Power. Obama supporters and former aides fanned out across the hall, and as Obama made his way to the arena, organizers started up the campaign refrain, fired up, ready to go. The speech also reflected the unique situation Obama will confront as he leaves office. At just 55, he is preparing for an active post-presidency in which he will champion many of the same core issues he worked on in the White House, including minority rights and opportunities for young people. And with an approval rating hovering just below 60% in many public surveys, he remains one of the nation's most popular political figures. Obama's remarks touched only marginally on his record. He touted the end of the Great Recession and other economic gains, foreign policy achievements such as restoring diplomatic ties to Cuba and a breakthrough with Iran to stall its nuclear program, as well as marriage equality in the U.S. and expansion of access to health care for 20 million Americans who had been uninsured. But he said, those achievements were not his alone. You were the change. You answered people's hopes, and because of you, by almost every measure, America's better, stronger place than when we started, he said. Instead, his focus was his optimism about civic engagement going forward after a bitter campaign to replace him and lingering concern about how President-elect Donald Trump will handle foreign relations, national security, the economy, and other big-ticket issues. He warned of further threats to American unity. Indeed, the audience booed when he spoke of the peaceful transition of power set to take place next week from him to Trump. He called for a new social compact to creating opportunity for all, or else, quote, the disaffection and division that has stalled our progress will only sharpen in years to come. And the nation's first black president reflected on how racial tensions, quote, as old as our nation itself, unquote, calling for greater understanding and acceptance of the increasingly diverse nation. Laws alone will not be enough. Hearts must change, he said. Senior advisors say Obama knows that many progressive, religious and ethnic minorities and immigrants are feeling apprehensive with the approach of the handover to Trump, who was elected after promising to crack down on immigration, scrutinize Muslims in the U.S., and challenge what he termed political correctness. A president whose White House team and its sprawling alumni network were wistful as they closed the Obama era. In recent days on social media, former aides have posted old photos from their underdog campaign in 2008 in early moments in the White House. The remarks were expected to be Obama's final address in office, though he may still conduct one more news conference before he leaves office on January 20th. Throughout his presidency, Obama has used his bully pulpit to inspire, condemn, and cajole. He was always heavily involved in writing his biggest speeches, and his team of young speechwriters spent as much time with him as did more senior staff. Chicago writers have always been at the heart of his craft. His earliest message guru was Chicago political mastermind David Axelrod, who helped him come up with the Yes We Can concept that propelled him into office. In his second term as head speechwriter had been Chicago native Cody Keenan, who worked with Obama on the farewell address throughout the holidays. Obama also worked on it for hours over the weekend. He was still at work on it Monday as his team prepared for the trip to Chicago. After he leaves office, he plans to take time to quiet himself and contemplate the last 8 years, said Valerie Jarrett, the president's longtime advisor and family friend. He wants to give Trump space to operate and won't comment on relatively small developments, friends say. He wants to give Trump, quote, room to do his homework, quote, Jarrett said. At the same time, Obama is aware that he can command attention when the moment's right, and if some development troubles him, he may speak out, he has said. For now, though, he hopes to leave a message of hope as he walks off the world stage. It's time for, quote, passing of the baton, quote, said Jen Psaki, P-S-A-K-I, the White House Communications Director. End of that article. Going from national to local, Decatur man gets thumbs up for police forensic work. Huey Freeman of the H&R staff wrote, Decatur, when Ed R. German was about to complete his studies at MacArthur High School in just 3 years, he received a job offer to work for the FBI in Washington, D.C. This was beyond the wildest dreams for a boy who had not imagined himself working in law enforcement, let alone joining the most storied agency in the nation. Then still under the directorship of its legendary founder, J. Edgar Hoover. Young Ed had excelled in math and science, sound foundations for his career, but his ambition at the time was more in the line of Christian ministry. From his start of one of 8,000 employees sorting through fingerprint cards in the massive FBI headquarters, German went on to distinguish himself as a groundbreaking forensic scientist. He is credited with creating new evidentiary techniques and helping to establish crime labs, including the Illinois State Police Lab, the first to receive national accreditation. He has served as Chief of Intelligence for U.S. Army law enforcement worldwide, worked on high-profile serial murder cases, including the Chicago area Tylenol and California Night Stalker cases, and served as a senior forensic scientist for the Army in Baghdad during the Iraq War. I have a picture here of the Legion of Merit, one of several prestigious honors earned by German. He has testified in more than 100 cases, including a 5-day trial in which the validity of the science of fingerprint identification was being challenged. The other experts were the senior fingerprint experts for the FBI and Royal Canadian Mounted Police. He cleared a Scottish detective of a perjury charge after similar fingerprints to hers were found at a murder scene. The agent told him, "We're always looking for fingerprint clerks. They have to be 16 years old, have a high school diploma, pass a spelling test and a background check," German said. My dad told him, "Send my son an application because he took the fingerprinting merit badge in Boy Scouts. He might like that." German went out to Washington and on an airplane by himself with the caveat that he would have to repay the airfare to the FBI if he didn't last through the first year of employment. "In the June of 1971, I went to work for the FBI as a GS-2 fingerprint clerk, making $82 a week after taxes," said German, 63, a congenial, down-to-earth man who likes to compare himself to Forrest Gump, the movie character who stumbled into numerous historical adventures. "My parents drove me to the airport. I cried myself to sleep in the hotel the first night. I thought, what have I got myself into?" Home to Help, an email German sent to Macon County Sheriff Thomas Schneider opened the latest chapter in his career. He wrote that he was moving back to the Decatur area, had decades of experience as a U.S. government fingerprint expert, and was interested in training local officers in the forensic sciences. Schneider responded promptly, hiring him effective January 15, 2016. German, who was returning to his hometown to care for his aging mother, Jeanette, made it clear that his salary was not his main objective. We were originally offering to pay him $9,000 for the year, but because of the budget constraints, he said he'd take only $10 every 2 weeks, Schneider said. There is no doubt in my mind that the work Ed will do for the sheriff's office will help solve many serious crimes and will help the victims of crimes. At the sheriff's office, German has established a database available at his fingertips, which includes all fingerprint arrest records from the Illinois State Police Automated Fingerprint Identification System, AFIS, database, which were submitted from all Macon County law enforcement agencies. The establishment of this database shortens the time of processing latent prints from about 5.5 months, the turnaround time for the Illinois State Police Lab, to a matter of minutes. It's instantaneous once we get them to him, Schneider said. He submits them to the database and does the search. We're very blessed to have a talented person come back to where he began. You can't pass up someone who could solve crimes like him. He came back here to retire, but also to give back to his community. Lieutenant John Butt said German brings a whole new perspective to the sheriff's office, viewing evidence as a scientist with a tremendous level of experience and expertise. We never had this before, Butt said. He wants to share his knowledge with everyone. He's a remarkable person. The database German has established has the fingerprints of more than 25,000 people, 54,000 sets in all, 20 prints from each set, 10 flat and 10 rolled, which include ridge details of the sides of each finger. There are cold cases we want to have him look at, Butt said. We think it's a perfect opportunity to have Ed look at this from a forensic science perspective. He's very detailed-oriented. The little things we might have missed, he might catch. It's just so awesome having him here. He could make so much more money anywhere else. He's such a humble person. That's what's so amazing about him. It takes a special talent to recognize the subtle difference between ridge features from one finger to another. One of his main missions is to train local officers who will meet international certification standards as certified latent print examiners. He is mentoring one officer in the sheriff's office and two at the Decatur Police Department to achieve certification. Decatur Police Detective Lieutenant Brian Cleary said the city department has already benefited from German's efforts with three recent positive fingerprint identifications. The database he's created is amazing, Cleary said. He can get us possible matches quickly. State's Attorney Jay Scott reads the arrest affidavits on a daily basis, which periodically report on burglars arrested several months after the crimes were committed because of the wait time on fingerprint evidence. He said German is proving himself as a positive asset for law enforcement in the community. I think it's fantastic to have someone with his expertise to help us solve local crimes, Scott said. Super glue guy. As the little headline, German has been involved in many aspects of fingerprint technology, including the establishment of laboratories and standards for fingerprint identification, as well as other branches of forensic science, including facial identification and iris imaging. His 22-page curriculum vitae, a detailed resume, reads like a record of someone of the stature of Thomas Edison or Benjamin Franklin. So one of the things here is a letter, short letter, from J. Edgar Hoover. Dear Mr. German, I am indeed pleased to advise you of your promotion to the position of fingerprint clerk, $6,544 per annum in grade GS-4, effective April 2, 1972. German retired from federal service after 10 years in the CIA, where he served as technical intelligence officer, 25 years in the Army, in which he reached the rank of Chief Warrant Officer 5, and 1 year with the FBI. He served 3 years as a forensic scientist or sworn officer with civilian police departments, 3 years as forensic scientist with Illinois state law enforcement agencies, and 2 years as a scientist with a leading manufacturer of lasers, where he was a pioneer in their utilization to analyze evidence. German accomplished all this without ever holding a college degree. After serving his 1 year as an FBI clerk beginning in 71, specializing in processing prints from unidentified corpses, the chief of police in Morristown, Tennessee, hired German as his fingerprint expert. The science of crime scene examination was then in its infancy. The chief, Mel Tucker, sent German, then 18, back to Washington to train with the Metro Police as an overall crime scene examiner. German served as police sergeant before his 19th birthday. 2 years later, when Tucker took a new job as police chief in Hickory, North Carolina, he invited German to join him. "I'm going to set up a regional crime scene examination team for a 3-county laboratory," Tucker told the young man, adding he would have a pay rise in his own police car. 1 year later, when Tucker was hired as chief in Chattanooga, Tennessee, he offered German a position on the city force. By then, German was instead considering joining the Army, which had international crime lab facilities. He enlisted in July 75, after he was told he'd be trained to be a forensic scientist. After basic training, a newly minted commander said he knew nothing of that offer. German was sent to work as a regular military police officer. When the Army decided German was better off as a forensic scientist, he was sent to a crime lab in Georgia for a 2-year training course as a latent print examiner. He said he wanted to challenge the test because of his extensive experience, far more criminal cases than any other 20-year Army examiner. They said nobody ever did that before, but allowed him to try. "It took me 83 days to complete the 104 weeks of training," German said. They'd never had an enlisted man as a forensic scientist in the U.S. Army crime lab system, so they had to invent a military occupational specialty for me. "I was the one and only ever 95 Delta II Dango Bravo X-ray enlisted forensic scientist in the Army." He became a special agent criminal investigator and was shipped to the Army Crime Lab in Tokyo, which supported all armed forces and U.S. embassies from the U.S. West Coast to the Soviet Union. He lived off base, so he taught himself Japanese to communicate with neighbors, his landlord. Because of that knowledge, he was able to uncover a secret formula the Japanese were using to process latent fingerprints in a petri dish for 7 days. Superglue. He and another researcher discovered they did not have to wait 7 days for the substance to produce result. "We could use heat to volatilize it, and within 10 minutes, we could develop fingerprints on non-porous surfaces, on glass, metal, plastic, in a fish aquarium. So I'm known as the co-inventor of the super glue development process that every police agency worldwide still uses. When I walk into foreign labs, the scientists would say, 'You're the super glue guy.'" I believe that is the end of that article. On to state. No state budget again as legislature wraps up. 99th General Assembly fails to okay spending plan for its 2-year plan. The headlines in the e-edition says, 99th General Assembly fails budget test. I would say again. This is by Dan Petrella, the H&R Springfield Bureau Chief. The 99th Illinois General Assembly adjourned Tuesday without passing a comprehensive state budget during its entire 2-year term. However, on the final day of their 2-day lame duck session, lawmakers did approve bills requiring schools to test water for lead, enacting a series of criminal justice reforms, and extending a controversial business tax credit program, among other measures. The House also approved a bill that would freeze the total amount of property tax revenue units of local government can collect without getting voter approval for an increase, but the vote was purely symbolic because there wasn't enough time for the Senate to take it up before adjourning. Still, the measure, sponsored by State Representative Mark Batenek, Republican Plainfield. One praise from Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, who has made property tax freeze one of the key pieces of policy agenda. Rauner said in a prepared statement that the House took a step in the right direction and passed our permanent property tax freeze. A property tax freeze, when you control whether your property taxes go up or not, will help change the system in Illinois, create jobs, and keep families from fleeing the state, Rauner said. Whether the concept becomes a reality once the new General Assembly is sworn in Wednesday remains to be seen. While there's widespread acknowledgement that Illinois' high property taxes are a burden on residents and businesses, opponents argue that freezing property tax will harm school districts, which rely on the money for much of their funding. Meanwhile, Rauner also expressed his support for a measure that would require schools that were built before 2000 and house preschool through fifth grade classes to test their drinking water for lead. The bill, which would also apply to daycare facilities, was approved in both chambers during the lame duck session with the bipartisan support. The measure, sponsored by State Senator Heather Steens, Democrat, Chicago, was a response to lead being found in the drinking water of about two dozen Chicago schools in the wake of the crisis over lead-contaminated water in Flint, Michigan. Also passed in both chambers with bipartisan support was a measure from State Representative Jahan Gordon Booth, Democrat, Peoria, that would create, quote, local trauma recovery centers to provide services to crime victims. The measure also would give offenders time off of their sentences for participating in addiction and mental health treatment, job training, and other programs while in prison, and give judges more discretion in sentencing people to probation instead of prison. The trauma centers will be a pilot program funded with federal money and administered by the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority. Crediting Rauner and House Speaker Michael Madigan, Democrat, Chicago, for their supportive efforts to reform the state's criminal justice system, Gordon Booth said the legislation is an indication of what can be done when two parties work together on important issues. We are in a space at this time, right now, if we have the ability to work together like we have on this legislation, we can move a lot of fantastic pieces of legislation, she said. The parties also came together to extend through April a controversial Economic Development for a Growing Economy tax credit program, better known as EDGE. The program has faced questions about its effectiveness in retaining and attracting businesses and jobs. Lawmakers plan to introduce a proposal to overhaul the program this spring. Before adjourning, the Senate didn't take up measures approved in the House on Tuesday that would have changed the state's workers' compensation laws and provided $658 million in short-term funding for social services and higher education. Those areas of the budget are without funding after the state's stopgap spending plan expired at the start of the new year. In the coming weeks, the Senate hopes to advance a mammoth budget compromise worked out between State President John Cullerton, Democrat, Chicago, and Minority Leader Christine Redaño, Republican, Lamont. The package includes an income tax increase, pension reforms, licenses for six new casinos, and a host of other measures. Senators on both sides of the aisle remain optimistic that it can serve as an outline for ending the standoff that has stretched throughout the first 2 years of Rauner's term. State Senator Bill Brady, Republican of Bloomington, said there are many components of the package that he doesn't like, including some of the tax provisions, but he believes the effort to reach a negotiated solution, quote, has been monumental in trying to push and lead us out of this rut, unquote. He continues, if we can pass something similar in a timely fashion, hopefully it'll give the House something to work on, Brady said. State Senator Gary Forby, Democrat Benton, who lost his re-election bid in November and served his last day in the Senate on Tuesday, said he hopes the plan is a step toward ending the impasse. There's one thing we've got to do here. We've got to go home and take care of the people in our district. And number one, you've got to have a budget. End of that article. And lastly, on the front page is a local education article. Decatur School Board considers alternative education plan. This is by Valerie Wells from the staff. The Decatur School District's alternative education program could be moving to Stephen Decatur Middle School. In a presentation at a Tuesday board meeting, Director of Student Services Lawrence Trimble and Interim Co-Superintendent Michael Dugan gave the board a proposal for changes to the program. Changes have been offered previously but have not met with board approval for a variety of reasons. These changes seem to correct the board's concern from past proposals. Among changes suggested were instruction with certified teachers rather than the APEX computer-based instruction used now, work-study opportunities to provide the students with career goals and experience, science, physical education, and electives opportunities with Stephen Decatur teachers, chances to take driver's education, participate in athletics, and after-school clubs and activities. We're emphasizing moving resources into one building, and Stephen Decatur is underutilized, so it seems the best fit, Dugan said. Alternative education students would have a separate entrance and bell times and class periods of 45 minutes, Trimble said. Additional Heritage Behavioral Center personnel are in the building 2 days a week, making someone available to alternative education students for in-school sessions. Board members will vote on the proposal at a later date, but their reactions to the presentation were positive. I'm glad we're moving away from APEX, said member B.A. Butts. Instead of working with a human being, an alternative education student is placed in front of a computer and learning about the world as work. Most of them have never been exposed to that and don't know what it is. Board member T.J. Jackson asked if an emphasis on improving reading could be included, as he said students' academic frustration often stems from an inability to read well. Dugan said an available computer program can adjust reading levels so that two students can read the same article at their own reading level and still come away with identical information. In other business, the board approved the hiring of Mary Ann Galligan as principal of Stevenson School and also approved a new contract with adult education director Rocky Wilkerson for a part-time position in that program at 20 hours a week. During public participation, Greater Decatur Black Chamber of Commerce members Tony Wilkins and Ingrid Smith asked the board to consider a greater emphasis on job training and vocational skills for Decatur students. Wilkins said unemployment in Decatur is 7% generally, but 20% among African Americans. In the school's industrial arts classes, including Heartland Technical Academy, participation by black students is very low. Projections are that skilled laborers will be in high demand in the next several years because schools are steering students to four-year colleges and not into vocational and technical training. Not all kids will go to college, Wilkins said, but if they don't, they need to be prepared for a career. Black Chamber members have studied this issue, he said, and visited a program in Champaign schools called Education to Employment Pipeline, which he suggested might serve as a model for Decatur schools. Now, a couple of quick briefs before we finish Section 1 of January 11, 2017, Decatur Herald and Review. Clinton, wreck kills two. Two women were killed in a fatal crash in DeWitt County on Monday night. DeWitt County Coroner Randy Rice said a vehicle was traveling west on Illinois 10 and left the roadway, rolling several times and landing in a field. The driver and passenger were ejected, including Tabitha Michelle Dixon, 21, of Decatur, who was pronounced dead at the scene at 12:05 Tuesday. Hannah Rice, 20, of Decatur, was transported to Carle Hospital in Champaign, where she was pronounced dead at 5:29 a.m., according to the Champaign County Coroner's Office. The crash occurred near Friends Creek, near Weldon, about 11:30 p.m. on Monday night. And then finally, Mattoon Lakeland Bonds. The Lakeland College Board of Trustees voted Monday to declare the college's intent to issue $1.33 million in bonds to fund infrastructure improvements on the main campus. Board Vice Chairman Dave Storm said the board's finance committee has recommended moving forward with the bond issue, and this declaration and related public notice are part of the process. They'll vote on this February 13th meeting. That is the end of Section 1, a Decatur Herald and Review. I'll be back. This is Debbie saying I will be back shortly.